Hey everybody, what's going on? Rob Cesternino here, and I am so excited for this episode of the podcast. We are going to be talking to somebody that I am very happy to have tracked down on the podcast today. We're going to be talking to one of the Survivor pioneers from the original Survivor season in Borneo, one of those 16 famous castaways, Dr. Sean Kniff. And we're going to talk through everything from his Survivor experience and beyond here on the podcast today. Very excited to have tracked down a great Survivor to talk about all of his experiences with. Looking forward to sharing that here with you guys today. Before we get into that, couple of quick things. Survivor 37 is around the corner, and we have announced our Survivor 37 live show in New York City. Still a couple of tickets remaining. And when I say a couple, I mean around like 30 or so. If you're listening to this, I haven't announced it on a Survivor podcast. It's sort of been word of mouth and the patrons buying them all up. I mentioned it on a Big Brother show. But if you just listen to the Survivor podcast, there's a chance that maybe this is the first time you're hearing about that. Go to robhasawebsite.com/S37KIA. That's robhasawebsite.com/S37KIA. That is going to be on October 3rd in New York City. Stephen Fishback, myself, and a number of Survivor alumni breaking down the second episode of Survivor, David versus Goliath. Also, Run It Up Reno, for those of you guys who are more on the West Coast, is going to be taking place later on in October. So be on the lookout for that. We have a sponsor, too, for today's podcast. I want to thank our friends over at Legacy Box. Legacy Box is great because they tackle a problem that so many of us have, that we have all of these home movies on various formats that may not be so easy to access, whether it's the VCR or God knows what else people have with all of these home movies. They have these great memories that they want to try to access and they can't because of technology. That's where Legacy Box comes in. I'm sure Dr. Sean has plenty of VHS tapes from all of his Survivor appearances after the show. Legacy Box can help you convert those to digital files that you can access anytime. I've had a great experience using Legacy Box. We sent in some videos that we had. I had a DV camera that I used to use in the early 2000s. Don't have any devices that can read DV tapes anymore. Legacy Box can take care of all of that. Everybody's got a stack of tapes at their house. Legacy Box makes it so easy. They send you a sturdy cardboard carrier. You load in all of your media. They get it. They barcode everything. They give you details step by step all through the process. Over 400,000 families have trusted Legacy Box with their old movies and photos. It's work that's done by hand here in the USA. It's a great gift for your parents. They'll be so thrilled that you took the time and the effort to go ahead and get all of these movies encoded. There's never been a better time to digitally preserve your old home movies, film reels, and photos. Visit LegacyBox.com to get started. Plus, for a limited time, they're offering our listeners a great exclusive discount. Go to LegacyBox.com/Rob to get 40% off your first order with this great deal. Legacy Box starts at just $45. Save up to $200 on the largest Legacy Box kit as well. Go to LegacyBox.com/Rob and save 40% today. Start with a few tapes or digitize your whole collection when you go to LegacyBox.com/Rob. Enter promo code Rob to save 40% off your Legacy Box today. Get started preserving your past. All right, everybody, I'm very excited to bring our guest in today. It would have blown my mind if you would have told me some 18 years ago that I would have a chance to talk to my fellow Long Island native who once upon a time made his way out to Survivor, and looking forward to catching up here with Dr. Sean Kniff. Sean, how are you?
Wonderful, Rob. Thank you for having me. So good to be part of your podcast.
Yes, Sean, this is a thrill for me, so thank you very much for taking me up on this invitation.
Oh, you got it. Anything for you, anything.
So anything. Sean, that you don't do a lot of Survivor talk, and we have not had the opportunity really to ever speak. I don't believe. And so I'm really looking forward to getting into some stuff with you today.
Yeah, you know, I don't, by rule, I generally don't do any Survivor stuff. Not because I don't enjoy the ride that Survivor gave you and I, you know, it was just amazing. But, you know, I think everything has a place and a time. And I think this is the first Survivor interview I've given in maybe, God, I don't know, 15 years.
Yeah.
You know, so early thereafter, I don't really do, you know, I know a lot of people go to parties and stuff like that, but I got a wife and three kids to contend with, so I don't have a lot of time to do things.
All right. Well, first, let's do the catch-up. So you mentioned the wife and three kids. Can you give people the update of what you're up to these days?
Yeah. I mean, so, well, you know, just the brief rundown of what's gone on in my life after Survivor is I worked for CBS News. I worked for Extra Television for a while. I stuck one foot in television, kept one foot in medicine for a long time. I'm a neurologist, just to remind people what my day job is. So I had that. I met a lot of people along the way who were very interesting. And one of them happened to be this brilliant little Cuban woman. She's Cuban American. She speaks better English than I do, but her name is Esther. And she graduated summa cum laude from Columbia University in New York. And we got married a short time later. And I have three wonderful children. I have Lilou Bell, L-I-L-O-U. It's a French name, even though she's Cuban and I'm Irish. But Lilou Bell. And then we have Lola and Logan, who are 3 years old. And they're the light of our lives. They put everything and keep everything in perspective.
And what part of the country are you in?
Oh, I live down in South Florida. It's a place called Weston. It's a suburb. We were living in Miami prior to this, where all the cool kids live. And once we stopped being cool kids and had a family, they kind of banish you to the suburbs. And that's where we are. We're out in a very nice suburb called Weston. And it's closer to Fort Lauderdale than Miami, but it's sort of in between both cities.
When did you end up moving to Florida?
Shortly after 9/11, something people probably don't know, at least in the Survivor community, I was a responder to 9/11. I was living in Midtown Manhattan when the plane struck, when terror struck. And I went down to – tried to get down to the World Trade Center at the time to help out. I didn't know what I would see there or dig, or I didn't know what I was going to do. But I put on scrubs. I went down there, and they marshaled me to St. Vincent's Hospital. And then I spent about a day at St. Vincent's Hospital, and then I didn't see anybody, unfortunately. Then they moved us all to Chelsea Pier, every New York State licensed doctor to Chelsea Pier, and I waited again another day to see people. And again, you either made it out or you didn't. But shortly after that, I didn't flee New York, but it was sort of like, okay, you know, life is painfully short and for some people, and it's time to, you know, lose this cold weather and do something else with my life. Kind of in a similar vein to where I was at when Survivor, when I took a chance just to try out for Survivor to change my life up. Very similar vein. I just wanted to do something different. And it wasn't I wouldn't say come to Jesus moment, but it was definitely intentional that I wanted to just do something different.
Yeah. Well, take us back to that point where I guess it was either late 1999 or early 2000, and you must have seen something that they were looking for people for this crazy idea. I believe you were head of neurology at the time.
Yeah, I was chief of neurology of the section, but that was during the residency. And after that, I was just an attending and had a teaching position at my hospital. So that's really what I was doing. But yeah, you know, it actually starts back before that. In about 1995, 96 or so, I pitched a show to MTV and Nina Justman, who was at the time the president of MTV News, because I always wanted to do medical broadcasting. And I was young. I was 24 or 25 at the time and always wanted to do medical television. And for the MTV idea, it was called MDTV, and I was going to pitch them a show. I did pitch them a show about, you know, drug abuse, cutting, depression, suicide, anything that affects the 12 to 24-year-old generation. And we actually got somewhere, and I was at the shooting a pilot type of situation, and then everything fell through, as things do in television. So everything fell through. And, you know, of course, I finished my training and did all that. But the TV bug never left me. And so as I was practicing, and you know, when you residency, I'm from an old school of residency where you work literally 100 hours a week, you sleep in the hospital. I work, you know, 40 hour shifts, 30 hour shifts every other day for 2 years of my life. And so it was brutal. And so when I was working in medicine, I found out, you know, that it was pretty much just, it was very corporatized, and there was, it was very much a business. And that's not really what I went into medicine for. So I figured I'd just quit my job. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to give 2.5 months notice. I didn't leave right away. I gave 2.5 months notice, and I was going to do Doctors Without Borders. I was going to do this thing called locum tenens, where you travel the country and you're, you know, sort of a country doctor, or you work in a jail, or, you know, just get some life experiences, just something different. And so when I called my roommate from medical school at that time, he was down at the University of Pennsylvania in his neurosurgical residency. And he's like, you what? You quit your job? You know, because his dad is a postman and my dad's a fireman, and we're two blue collar kids who did well for ourselves. So it was like, you know, let's talk about it. Come on down to Philadelphia and let's talk about it. So I get on the train from New York to Philadelphia, and I'm drinking a can of, I don't know, Peels or whatever it was, or Budweiser on the beer car on the way down there. And I was reading Time Magazine, and there was an article in Time Magazine. I have it somewhere. And it was called "The Star Is Borneo," and what happened is they were looking for 16 ordinary Americans to try out for this show. So I ripped out the page, and it was a picture of Mark Burnett, Roz, one of the producers, and a couple other people sitting around a television monitor. And I figured I ripped it out, I stuck it in my pocket. I forgot about it for a few hours and a few beers. But then later on that night, I'm hanging out my buddy, the neurosurgeon, is like, "So what are you going to do with your life?" And I said, "Oh, maybe I'll try out for this show and we'll see what happens." That's literally how it happened. If I didn't read that magazine, if I didn't see that article, I would never have applied. And next thing you know, I'm on a plane to Borneo.
I mean, it's like a scene out of a movie that you filed away this newspaper clipping or this magazine clipping and said, here's exactly what I'm going to do. And you went out there. And when did the casting process start?
It started right away, you know, about a few weeks after I submitted an application. This is like a long time ago. This is like before, you know, everyone had phones on their cameras, and I didn't have a VHS. I had to actually go out, rent a video camera to shoot my VHS tape and send it in with FedEx or snail mail or whatever it was. But then, you know, several weeks later, I got a call to New York, and I interviewed in at CBS Broadcasting Center. And, you know, I was surrounded by other people who I thought were definitely going to get the job. They were, you know, there was some other doctor there that worked at, I don't know, maybe it was Presbyterian, one of the other area hospitals. And she had gone down the Amazon and worked with local tribes on healthcare. And I figured that's what they're going to put out there. That person's, because, you know, much more equipped to be out in the woods than I was. But as you know, they kind of reversed cast. They weren't looking for a survivalist type doctor out there. They kind of wanted a fish out of water. And they got that with me. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought I was going to be put out there as a young, hip, single doctor from New York,
yeah,
all of which I had deluded myself into being. And it turns out they wanted me as a dorky yuppie who's useless out in the woods. You know, might be book smart, but a real numbskull when you throw them out on a deserted island. So, you know, it's funny how they reverse cast that. I mean, I'll accept that stereotype. I would say it's fairly true. The only times I'd gone camping beforehand were basically a ruse to trick girls into tents. Like, you know, there was really no camping going on.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's, you know, I deserve the reputation I got out there. But that's what they were looking for. They're always, you know, anyone that's interested in trying out for Survivor, they're looking for a mastermind kind of like you, even though you were a benevolent mastermind in some sense. Compared to like Richard, you know, you were a benevolent mastermind. Richard just wore his, you know, he was as upfront and confrontational as he was naked. I mean, he was just naked, you know, and I voted for him and I still consider him a friend, but he was a different kind of villain than you are. You were just like, very smart in your calculating, I would say, and strategic. So Richard was too, but they were looking for someone. They were looking for a mastermind like you on your show. They were looking for a bitchy character. They're looking for a naive character. They're looking for a sexy character. They're looking for all these stereotypes that exist already in America, and they kind of reverse cast them and then stick them all out on the island. So, you know, your trick to getting on Survivor is be interesting in your life. You know, be one of those stereotypes and be yourself. You can't go in and pretend you're a mastermind when you're really not.
Yeah. And when you were going through these interviews, what did they tell you about what you were going to do? Obviously, you knew you were going to live on an island, but was there an emphasis on the game? Was there an emphasis on just the survival?
And it probably changed with subsequent iterations of the show. We were all completely naive to the program, the process. None of us had any television experience. It was just, we knew it was going to be a deserted island. We had no idea how we were going to get there. We had no idea who the other contestants were going to be. In fact, I often tell people the second part of the process, after you cleared the New York one, they flew, I would say, about 80 people out to Los Angeles, well, Santa Monica. And they had us up at the DoubleTree Hotel out there. And we were given express instructions to not talk to anybody, not a waitress, not the staff, not anyone else. You couldn't talk to anybody. So you have all these, by and large, young people around at the DoubleTree Hotel in Santa Monica, and you couldn't talk to any of them, and you couldn't talk to the waitress, couldn't talk to anybody. And I swear to God, if you were an outsider who came into the DoubleTree, you must be like, did I miss something? Is there like a loner convention in town or something? Yeah. Because you could not talk to anybody. And the casting process was really fun. I don't know what it was like for you. I couldn't talk about it with anybody else. But for instance, there was one test where there's a room and, you know, two of the producers are in there. And there's a bunch of Polaroids on the wall and there's an empty chair there. And there's a card on the empty chair, a little index card. And I'm waiting and waiting outside the room. And then Rudy comes out shaking his head. Remember Rudy, the Navy SEAL?
I remember him very well. I spent a couple of weeks with him when we got voted off on the All-Stars.
Yeah, he's amazing. Just a wonderful person. So he came out. I didn't know who he was at the time. He was just, you know, some old guy to me at the time. I didn't know. He comes out shaking his head and smirking and he walks away. Then they call me in. And they're sitting there. They turn. There's a camera like to your left and a camera square on your face. And they say, okay, go have a seat in that chair. And they say, listen, see this index card. You're gonna turn. We're gonna start the cameras. You're gonna turn it over, and you're gonna answer the three questions on there. And after you're done with those three questions for about 15 minutes, if you have anything else after you answer the questions fully, then yeah, I guess just entertain us or do whatever comes natural to you.
Yeah.
Right. And now behind me, there was a bunch of Polaroids, like, you know, either rejected contestants or whatever contestants, I don't know. But that was really the only other prop in the room. And so they turn on the cameras, they leave the room, and then you're sitting there waiting and you flip over the card. It's like name, hometown, and age or something like that. So it's like, I'm Sean Kniff. I'm a neurologist from this town. And I was 29 at the time. And that's it. Then you have seriously like 10 minutes or something to entertain them. And, you know, I did the old Jim Carrey talking butt thing. I told some funny stories. I did whatever. One thing I did not do, had I thought of it, I would have done it. But I didn't do the Blair Witch trial because the Blair Witch film.
Very popular.
Right. So it was very popular. And that was supposedly just the sentence of death. They would have thrown your videotape right on the heap after that. It didn't come to me. Had it come to me, I would have done it for sure.
Yeah.
But nothing came to me. I showed them like my teeth. I was like, does this look infected to you? And I did a bunch of other stupid stuff. But however it was, it must have been enough to get through that round. But it was things like that they did to you that was really, you know, in retrospect, it was really fun. And I knew they got me like right after. I was like, oh, those MFs, they got me. This one. Here's 10 minutes, entertain us. You know, it was they're quite ingenious. And it was really something to do to go through that kind of thing.
Okay, so they tell you you're on the show. You eventually start to make your way out to Pulatiga. And eventually, you know, there's this iconic TV moment of that you are being marooned off the boat. Could you just take us through a little bit of what that was like being there and being, you know, thrust into the situation, thrown off the boat, and then eventually getting to that first survivor beach?
Yeah, it was great, you know. I'm sort of a New York City slicker. I hadn't really traveled a lot. I think that was the first time I was on a plane ever for a long time, you know, for at least since childhood. It was definitely the first time I was on a plane in my adult life because I never had time. And then when I had time, I never had money. So it was very strange to be in an exotic location. There was about 2 days of like teaching us what to eat and what not to eat. Don't eat this berry, you'll die. And don't hunt this monkey because, you know, it's under protection or whatever. And, you know, you go through these little training type things. And then they walked us through this little Borneo village where houses are on stilts and stuff. We got on like a little Japanese junket ship, and it sailed us out in the middle, about a 3-hour trip out into the middle of the South China Sea. And we all knew at this point we were able to talk to each other or get to know each other to some respect. We weren't allowed to talk about specifics, but we could talk about like the matter of the day. So people are chatting a little bit. We knew that Mark Burnett had been a paratrooper, and we thought for sure that we were going to be parachuting into this area or something. A lot of us did. But lo and behold, they take us out in the middle of the South China Sea. We don't even know. I don't think we knew that this was our stranding day. We thought that they were going to be, you know, taking us to a beach or something. But then they chop off two big bamboo rafts into the water. They go, okay, everyone abandon ship. You know, this team's going to that island. That team's going to this island. Take whatever you can from the boat, and you're out. And that was Jeff saying, and that was it. Everyone just jumped ship and threw stuff over, and we started paddling. And you know, it was about, I don't recall, you know, I'd have to watch the Survivor show again, but it felt like 8 hours of swimming, but it was probably closer to 2 or 3. I don't really remember, but it was a long time swimming. And I swam in high school competitively, and I could swim. It felt like I was in the water forever.
Yeah.
And lugging that big raft. And when we finally get to the beach, it was dusky. Like, what the heck are we going to do now? We can't go out and build a house. There's none. We got to get water. We just gotten there, and the sun was probably about 2 hours away from setting. So we all just kind of slept on the sand there. It was, you know, you could talk to everybody, get to know everybody, and relax a little bit. And, you know, I would say if you watched the very first episode of Survivor 1, you kind of got the feel for exactly the rest of the show, who was who and what was what for the rest of the show, because it was established pretty early that Richard was mouthy and bossy and thought he was king of the show from day one. So it was, you know, it was interesting. The tone was set from there on out, I'd say. But it was bizarre. It was just bizarre.
Yeah, it's really iconic stuff. Of course, in that first episode, Richard goes up in the tree and everybody is working on building the shelter. And Rich is talking about how he wants to talk about the process. And, right. You know, it's sort of set up that, you know, Richard very well could be the first person that gets voted out of the game. And Sue is saying, look, we're not here to talk. We're here. You know, this is, you know, we're out here in the bush. We got to start working on this stuff. Did you get a sense that, okay, this guy is probably going to be the first person we want to get rid of?
Yeah, I mean, but everyone was being a little strategic because I needed him around because he's a body, right? There's going to be strength. And we had Sonia on our team who has breast cancer survivor, but she's, you know, she was in her 60s, I think. And we had Rudy who was 70, you know, we knew he was a Navy SEAL, but he's an older guy, 72 at the time. You know, there was a bunch of people there, and Stacy was a lawyer, but she didn't look all that, you know, it wasn't like Sue where you can think, all right, this person could take care of herself in the woods. So there's a bunch of people that were clearly just at first glance we're going to have to be sacrificed before Richard in terms of just physical prowess, you know? Mm-hmm. What if there was a tug of war? We could at least strap a rope around Richard and let him sit there, you know what I mean? So I didn't know what we were in store for. So I don't think anybody in their right mind would have gotten Richard, voted him off the island, no matter how annoying he was, because we're all there to win. It was a contest for $1 million. And I wouldn't want to weaken my team, no matter how annoying he was. So I don't see him going in the early round at all.
Sean, in that first episode, you know, you're attending to Sonia a little bit. I think she gets, you know, scraped up in the challenge. How often did you actually need to do any sort of doctorly duties for the other contestants?
Not really at all. I mean, just Sonia in the beginning, you know, here and there, little thing. Like after the teams merged, like Colleen had sores all over her legs. I didn't know what they were. Turns out that we were all taking a daily multivitamin like everyone was, and she wasn't. So it was probably a vitamin deficiency, maybe even scurvy, because that's kind of what scurvy looks like.
Yeah.
Vitamin C deficiency, but you know, no, it's never really seen anymore because everyone eats. But it turns out she hadn't been taking her multivitamin every day. But no, I mean, outside of that, it was just kind of everyone surviving, to pardon the pun. But we have medical oversight. There is a very competent doctor that was overseeing everybody. He wasn't there all the time. Mm-hmm. He wasn't on site all the time, but he would visit every 2 weeks or something like that, make sure everyone was okay. Little bug bites here and there I remember taking care of, but nothing really major. I remember Richard got some of the torch oil spilled on him at one point when it was lit. He had a couple of little burns, but I mean, it's something that, you know, you've done yourself taking a pizza out of the oven. You know, there was nothing really crazy about it. So it was all sort of fine.
It seemed like from watching the show that the person you were the closest with in the early days of the game was Dirk. How did you guys start that friendship?
I don't know. Dirk's just a down-to-earth guy and a good guy. He's a Christian. You know, I was Catholic, you know, I mean, as much as most Catholics are from Long Island nowadays. But, you know, but I was raised Catholic. But I believe in God and I talk to God every day. So it was nice to have someone with those kind of values out there. And he's just a good person. So it was fun. And he was young. I figured he might be someone who I could ally with that would have some strength on our team. Because a lot of people make fun of me for the alphabet voting strategy. And we'll touch upon that later. But all the young people, Jervis, Jenna, Colleen, Gretchen, and Greg, they were all at the front of the alphabet, you know, like Dirk was also, but it's like they threw us, we can't have all the old people on one team and all the young people on another. And I think they basically gave us Dirk, you know, like that's what I think happened. So I needed to keep like a young person around and get on that young person's side. Cause at this point, and I mean, my friendship with him wasn't strategic. I mean, he's just a good person, but at the same time, he was definitely the most physically fit and the youngest. I think he had the right combination of the right things for any physical feat at that time. So he's someone I thought would make a good ally.
Were there any people in that initial group that really got under your skin in terms of living with 24/7?
Well, Richard. I mean, everybody. You know, Richard is Richard. I mean, that's how he is. That's who he is. He'll never change. Yeah, but he got underneath everyone's skin. But I'm like a really easygoing person. I get along with almost everybody. And I allow people latitude to be themselves in life. And it's just the way I've been my entire life. And Richard is Richard. I can't correct him. He was a 40-something-year-old guy at the time. You know, I'm not his dad. I'm not going to tell him how to act and how to behave. And I wouldn't act or behave like he does or did, because not in my nature. My nature is more laid back and laissez-faire, and Richard's not that way. So he got underneath everyone's skin. You know, what people don't realize about Survivor is that there's other players in Survivor with the producers. It's sort of like the third wheel on a date. So, like, I remember one time Sue and I thought everything was great. You know, going fine. And during one of the interviews, so what's going on with you and Sue? Seems like she's a little, I was like, she's irate. She's mad at me. Like, well, I don't know what's going on with Sue. I thought everything was fine. You know, so there's a lot of that goes on. And you can kind of figure out where people are from some of the questions from the producers. I mean, they try to stay as impartial and not affecting the show at all. But I remember one time where they asked me, what's going on with you and Sue? And at the time, I thought everything was fine with Sue and I. So, you know, I think I got underneath people's skin. They got underneath my skin. You know, you can't throw 16 Americans out on an island and not have, you know, with no food, no water, and in the heat in the middle of the equator, you know, middle of South China Sea, 8 degrees north of the equator, and not have people's, you know, be at each other's throats. I mean, that's just the natural condition, I think. Yeah. So, yeah, everyone annoyed me to some extent, and you know, it's and vice versa. I'm sure of that.
Sean, I actually spent a lot of time living with Sue Hawk. Maybe not a lot of time, but I spent almost 2 weeks living with Sue Hawk on Survivor All-Stars. So that we have that in common.
Yeah, she's wonderful. I mean, she was like, you know,
I thought she was really fun, too. I really enjoyed my time with Sue. Yeah,
she's great. Don't stay in touch on Facebook. We, you know, I don't stay in touch with anybody, but if anyone I stay in touch with her and Rudy probably, and Joel and Jervis and Jenna. But but you know, but she'll drop me a note or vice versa every now and then, just to say hello. And she's just a good person. And you know, she was like the bratty older sister, and I was like the bratty younger brother. That was very much our relationship out there. And I would say that was, you know, pretty. Simply put, but that's how it was. And I look up to her. I think she's a wonderful person. She was always just a lot of fun to be around and mouthy, and she is what she is. She was just a really honest, good person, I thought.
One of the Taghi tribe members that we don't really know a lot about is Stacy. Did you find her difficult to live with?
No, not at all. I mean, I got along with Stacy really well. And, you know, there was a little bit of a lawsuit or something. I don't know if I'm privileged to talk about it or not. I don't have any idea what that lawsuit was about. There was nothing, no collusion or whatever. For me, it was just a thing. We were talking about who's the weakest link, you know, who's going to take us forward through this. And, you know, my opinion, just physically, I thought that Rudy was a better fit than Stacy. And Stacy just wasn't a strong player in terms, she wasn't physically strong and she didn't seem that mentally strong. I wouldn't call her mentally weak. She's a lawyer. So I wouldn't say she's mentally weak. She's probably as tough as I am mentally, but I wouldn't have said that I was the strongest player out there either, you know? So, but you know, I thought that that was, you know, I don't, again, without expanding too much on the lawsuit that happened, I don't know where, I really don't know where it came from. And, but I liked her. I thought I liked her really a lot as a person. But it, for me, it was just a strategic thing. Like, who did I need here to help, you know, with, you know, physical challenges and stuff. And I just think that from a physical standpoint, she wasn't a liability, but she wasn't a strength. That was my thinking at the time.
Sean, you were also known for a couple of your inventions on the island, of course. We all remember the Super Pole 2000, which was your fishing rod, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So I wanted to have some fun, wanted to make a fishing rod, never caught a dang fish with it. But actually, I could listen, you have nothing to do out there with your time, as you know, Rob. And, you know, I was on the inaugural show and they threw that thing on the fire heap at the end of the show for some reason where they could have kept it. It would have been something.
On eBay, at least.
Yeah, on eBay or something. You know, it would have been worth something. But, you know, it was something to do. And I just wanted to make something. You know, idle hands are the devil's playground. You're out there. You have a lot of idle time out there. Mm-hmm. And I figured, why go down? And if I have, I think we had a hook. We had some styrofoam. And we had some fishing line. Why not make a fishing pole out of it? And that's what I did. And I could cast that thing, you know. It wasn't – it was – pretty rudimentary fishing pole, but you know, I could cast it. I was pretty happy that I could cast it out and I could reel it in. I mean, that was, what else you want of a fishing pole? So I was pretty happy. And you know, it was tongue in cheek, of course, naming it Super Pole 2000.
Yeah.
And then of course it became even more ironic when you can't catch a damn fish with it. So but that, it was fun. You know, I would, not only would I make the Super Pole, you know, 2000 again, I would have been more vocal about how great my Super Pole 2000 is, even knowing if it wouldn't catch any fish, because that thing was awesome.
Yeah, Super Pole 3000.
Right, exactly.
Sean, you also built a bowling alley. Are you a big bowler?
No, not at all. I've never, in fact, I went bowling the other time, I don't know, about 2-3 weeks ago with my family. And I think I scored like a 70 or something like that. But there's nothing to do. There's nothing to do out there except get your water, build your house, tend to the roof. And listen, anyone from Survivor can critique me for a million things. But one of the things is I'm a worker. I definitely ascribe to the John Milton philosophy, you know, the philosopher and writer John Milton. A man is a worker. If he's not that, he's nothing. I have worked my entire life. My dad's a New York City firefighter. I've spread asphalt. I've flipped burgers. I've delivered pizzas. I've been the campus snack bar guy. Mm-hmm. I've been a lifeguard. I've been a paper delivery. I've been a landscaper. I've been a waiter. I've been a busboy. You name it, I've done the job. And I always work really hard at all those jobs. And I was one of the hardest workers out there, beyond a doubt. I wasn't lazing around in the shade, but we needed something to kill our time.
Yeah.
So why don't we cut down some bamboo, make some basic pins. We got the coconuts and we'll make a little bowling. All we got to do is flatten the sand. And all of a sudden I'm vilified for trying to have a little fun out there. I don't think people in the audience understand how much work actually gets done, how much I actually worked. And, you know, it was time to have fun. I'm a 29-year-old guy out there. Let's have some fun.
Well, it really spoke to the differences in those two first tribes where, you know, this would have been celebrated had it been done at Pagong, but there was like disdain coming from Sue Hawk toward the, oh, Sean is building that bowling alley and that Super Pole. Yeah. So stupid. He could be out there catching tapioca. Yeah.
Right.
So,
well, all that's true too. I gotta say, all that's true. But listen, life's for living. If anyone who's listening to your podcast Like, I've had a very rich life. I mean, I stumbled accidentally on the nation's number one TV show. I have a beautiful life, beautiful wife. I've, you know, done so many interesting things, only because, like, be open to doing silly things. Be open to doing things to people saying, why would you be doing that right now? Because you want to be doing that right now. That's all you need. That's a good enough reason. Just go out and do what you want to do. And that's what I wanted to do out there. But, of course, when they threatened to vote me off the island and I still got medical school loans to pay, you kind of have to tell them, so.
Go along with it. John, when they have the summit, when you guys finally get to that first merge, they sent you and Jenna Lewis off to the island. I always thought that the producers were hoping that there would be some sort of romantic spark between the two of you. Were you guys picking up that vibe from production?
Oh, yeah, for sure. They put us in, I think the beds were together in the tent when we first got there. You know, yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, they ask you when you're being interviewed way back in the California days before we even shipped off, who among this cast, I mean, which girls have you seen here that you find attractive? Who do you think is not attractive? Like, they ask you all that with the photos. At least they did to me. And I know that they were looking for that. And they asked explicitly, would you hook up on television? Would you feel comfortable doing that? And truth be told, I probably said no, but somehow got chosen anyway. I was like, I wouldn't do that. I mean, I'd embarrass my family.
Who were the other options that they were going to send, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, but, you know, Jenna's very attractive, you know, and Jenna, I think, you know, she's cute. I think she would have been a willing participant, but there was no interest in that because, like, you haven't cleaned yourself in a month. You haven't showered in a month. You stink to high heaven. It's just not really that romantic to be out there. And I know a lot of guys are thinking, like, listen, you're 29, your testosterone surging. What do you do in the mornings? You know, we all have a morning visitor. That just does, you're under such starvation circumstances out there. None of that even factors in. I don't think I had any kind of romantic thought when I was out there, let alone a sexual thought. It was just not, it's the last thing you're thinking of. Right, it's true. Listen, I'm 48 now, and I still get my morning visitor. Thank God, everything's still working. But you don't have that out there. You're out there, you're starving. None of that's around. You know,
Sean. It was at the merge also that this alphabet strategy that you touched on earlier really came to be, and there was so much talk about that from back then to even now. Everybody knows about the alphabet strategy. And so a couple of years ago, I went back and I had never rewatched Survivor Borneo from the year 2000. And I watched it again. And I started having these thoughts about what you were doing back in Borneo. And I thought that maybe that there was a method to your madness that maybe and you touched on it about the people that were from Pagong had the names that were further up in the alphabet than the names from Tagi. But how much was the alphabet strategy coordinated with what the Tagi alliance was doing?
It was coordinated. I mean, I knew, contrary to what, you know, that you see on TV, like, oh, maybe they're all a lie. I mean, I knew exactly what was going on with them. But again, getting to the producers being sort of like the third wheel here, like, you could sort of figure out what's going on. And I knew I couldn't explain my strategy with the alphabet strategy because I feared that they would go and say something to the other team. But what I noticed is, you know, and how it would be, like I said, the producers don't control the show, but they steer the show. Any reality television, I'm a big fan of the Bachelor series, and thanks to my wife, and 85-86% of the show, of reality, of any reality television show, is a direct response to producer questions. So they're like, hey, Rob, come talk to us in the woods over here. And they set you up in the woods and they ask you questions. What's going on with this person? What's going on with that person? And what do you think about this? And what I feared when I came up with the alphabet strategy was that the producer was like, so do you think Sean's just being a neutral, nice guy? Or do you think it's actually because of this? Right. And I knew that that question could come up and I didn't want my cover blown. But what I noticed is that my team was all older, but also at the back of the alphabet. So after the merger, I had Rich, Rudy, Sue, and Kelly, and me. I'm Sean with an S. So we're all the back end of the alphabet, whereas all the other team, the Pagong tribe, was Jervis, Jenna, Colleen, Gretchen, and Greg. They were all at the front of the alphabet. And that was not by coincidence. I really think that when they stratified the teams early on, they were like, all right, well, we can't have all the young kids on one team. Let's give the older team Dirk. You know, like that's really what I thought they did. They just switched two people. But that's the way it went down. So I noticed that they were all at the front of the alphabet. And I knew there was an alliance. So you got to win $1 million from the jury. So what I would figure is like, listen, I'm going to be impartial. I'm just going to vote. I'm going to be vocal about it. I'm going to vote alphabetical order. And I'm going to go by the name your mom gave you. You know, not that I gave you. It's not my fault. I'm going to go, and hopefully people, if they knew who I was voting for by alphabetic order, they would say, hey, I'm going to throw my vote on that person to eliminate the competition. So from a mathematical point of view, it made sense. And then also knowing that Rich, Rudy, Sue, and Kelly were going to be voting in a block, then I also knew at that point that, like, wait a minute, if they're voting in a block, I get to look – if I end up making it to the very end – then I look impartial to the jury because I was just voting in alphabetical order. I'm not part of the evil alliance. And on top of that, so I'm not part of the evil alliance and I'm voting with the name your mom gave you. I still got to vote for the entire other team, Jervis, Jenna, Colleen, Gretchen, and Greg, before I would have to vote for anybody on the alliance. So they would know that they're far down the alphabet. So they would feel less threatened by me. That was my thinking out there the whole time. But I couldn't say that. A, it would probably bore everybody to death. But I also feared that if I told anybody that, then they would go and, you know, that a producer might be like, do you think Sean's just being a nice guy and impartial? Or do you think it's coincidence that, you know, Jervis, Jenna, Colleen, Gretchen, and Greg are all at the front of the alphabet, that he gets to vote your team out before his own? You know, so I didn't want anything like that to ruin my game plan. So you just have to know that's what it was. But I mean, listen, if everyone wants to go on and on for Survivor ad infinitum and call me a numbskull for doing what I did, that's absolutely fine. I was really being real out there. That's the real strategy behind it. I was trying to win $1 million the best way I know how, because I mortgaged my future to become a doctor, and you know, I had to pay off my student loans. I mean, that's the way it is. And, you know, that's what I was trying to do. And to me, if I could do it all again, the one thing I would change about the alphabet strategy is I would have stuck with it. I abandoned it at some point because Rich, Rudy, Sue, and Kelly were saying, we're going to vote you off next if you vote for whoever it was. but they were going to vote me out the next one. I sort of had to, unless I abandoned the alphabet thing. So, but had I stuck with it, I think maybe I would have won. But you never know.
Yeah, I think that really it was about the messaging, and maybe the messaging to the audience was the issue, where if you would have been able to articulate that in sort of the interview, and I don't even know if they would have shown it, but In watching the show, I felt like that you were probably one of the more savvy contestants in terms of, this is going to be a show that is going to be seen on national TV. I know you had aspirations to do things after the show. I believe that was one of the reasons why you wanted to bring the razor, because you wanted to, you know, keep up a, you know, clean appearance being on television.
Well, listen, let me get to the razor for a second, because I'm a hairy Irish beast, you know, and I got testosterone surging through my system. Even now, I have too much testosterone, I think. And I can't just go to a deserted island. I would look like a wildebeest, you know, coming out by the end of a month. So everyone shaves their chest now. I mean, almost everyone.
You were the original manscaper.
Right. I was manscaping because
before it was cool.
Right. On network TV, I'm 29 years old, single, doctor, living in New York. I get one chance to be on network television, maybe for the remainder of my life. And, you know, at the time, I didn't think it was going to even be a big show. You know, just thought it was going to be some show. But I'm on TV for in front of all of America. And what? I'm going to look disgusting. I'm gonna look worse than I typically look on any given day. You gotta be kidding me. I want to look your best. I mean, that's just normal human behavior, at least to me. So I wasn't gonna drop the opportunity to look my best on network TV, or at least the best that I can look, considering the the situation. I don't want to go out there and all of a sudden turn into like, wow, he was cute when he started the show. Look at what a monster he is. Yeah. You know?
But you're thinking about these things where maybe nobody else from that season was thinking about, you know, what is my perception going to be? Or maybe not thinking about it as much as you are. Was that also part of it where I don't want to be seen as a villain is part of, because the Alliance, it's kind of a dirty word in that first season, and I don't want to be seen as part of this group. So here I'm not, you know, doing anything underhanded. I'm just voting for these people because of some arbitrary order.
Absolutely. I mean, that was, and you know, people forget I'm a neurologist, like I'm a caretaker, and I take that seriously. I don't just, you know, I of course provide care to patients, but I also care about my patients. Like I'm a very empathetic person. I like my patients, and I couldn't go out there and act like a complete fool or a villain, and because that A, it's not me, I'd be faking it, but B is that, you know, I have a career that I can't look that way on a grand public scale. I mean, it's just, it's not professional, and it's not who I am, but it's also not professional. Imagine if your doctor was out there and doing what Richard did. I mean, I know that it's like, hey, good for him, my doctor won. But, you know, he was annoying. Everyone was like, that's your doctor? I don't want to go to him, you know? So, I mean, that did factor in for me a little bit. But like I said, I was really trying to win. Anyone could say, I'm confident in my reasons for voting in alphabetical order, why I did it. And it was very strategic. I'm sorry, no one else recognized the strategy. I kept it secret from the producers because I didn't want the producers spilling the beans. I didn't know if they would or they wouldn't. But after a couple of interviews, you can kind of figure out what the heck is going on with other people by some of the questions that they're asking. So I didn't want anyone to know what I was up to because I want to keep it secret. Maybe had I won, I would have been like, ha-ha, you guys are all at the front of the alphabet, and thank you for the $1 million. You know, maybe I would have said something like that, but even then I probably wouldn't have. Maybe in the talk show afterward, I would have been like, what no one noticed and only I noticed was that the whole other team came at the front of the alphabet. I mean, but, you know, I just was really trying to win $1 million. But, yeah, certainly appearances are important, and I wanted to, you know, look my best because I was single and on network television, so I wanted to make sure that no one was repulsed by me. Mm-hmm. And then, second of all, I also wanted to make sure above everything that I'd come out of this with my neurology career intact.
So I want to ask you about one particular vote where Jenna Lewis was the person that was the person who went home. And so we find out at that vote, there's a caveat where Jervis had won immunity at a point where I think that he would have been the person to get the alphabet vote. We find out that the part of the stipulation of the alphabet strategy is that because Jervis had won immunity, you weren't going to double back and get him. And that you were going to be putting your vote on Jenna because her turn was up. But if you felt like that, if she was in any danger, you would not have put a vote on her. And that is also going to be when the Tagi Alliance is going to vote for her. Do you know, was this a chicken and egg scenario where they knew you were voting for Jenna and they piled their votes on? Or did you know that she was going to be voted out and then maintain the posture of, oh, if I would have known, I wouldn't have voted for her? Because that's also the night when Richard gets a couple of votes, and that's the closest that he's going to come here up until the final four to get voted out. So which was it, Sean?
Yeah, you know, the details are kind of sketchy, but from
you can tell us now. The game's over.
Yeah, no, but from that vote, like, they were playing me too, the Alliance, you know? So I would have to say that I did not know that they were going to be voting for Jenna. There's a lot of times when you're out there, I'm sure just like you and Amazon, Rob, where people say they're voting one way and then they do something else. And there was a lot of that. I mean, there was a ton of time, but I would not have done that. If I thought Jenna was in jeopardy of going home, I wouldn't have done that because it would have, you know, it wouldn't have blown my alphabet strategy, but at the same time, that's just not the way I operate. I would have, you know, abandoned it earlier if I was convinced that they were going to vote her out. Because I think at the time I didn't think of her as that much of a threat. I just wanted to get rid of all the people that were physical threats and then mental threats. And I don't mean that sounds disparaging against Jenna, but I didn't see her as that. I just wanted to eliminate threats primarily and stay neutral. So I think knowing me and thinking back on there and knowing that there was a lot of times when they said they were going to vote for this person, they vote for another person, that was probably one of those times, because I could only go back in time and say what I would have done. But yeah, I don't remember that. And I would remember if I knew that Jenna was going to go, I would know that. So that's something I wouldn't have done, I don't think.
Sean, another historical note from that season was that you were the first recipient of a loved one's visit from Survivor. Yep. When you won the reward, you got to go on the cruise ship and your dad was waiting for you there on the ship. What was that like, having that moment on the show?
I mean, it's absolutely amazing. If I got nothing out of the show and I got to spend that little bit of time with my dad, that's all that matters, because, you know, life is brief. My dad is so fortunate to still be with me. I'm still lucky to have him. My dad, though, is everything. And my mom, nothing against my mom. But when you fill out your application on Survivor, this is how it was, as if you can get a letter from anybody on the island, who would it be? And I wrote my mother. And I mean that. I would want, if I'm stuck on a real deserted island all by myself, I'd want to hear from my mom. You know, and I answered honestly. And if I could be, they asked me, if you could be stuck with any person on the island, who would it be? And I wrote my dad. And I mean that, because if anyone's going to put their life above mine and try to get me off the island, it would be my dad. I didn't know that they were using those questions as, as, you know, as who would come. So some people wrote like David Letterman, like, you know, because this way to keep him laughing, or Selma Hayek or something. I think Jervis did put Selma Hayek on the island with him. But I mean, I was being serious. I took the question seriously. I wrote my dad. And that's a true story. For what everybody knows about New York City firefighters running into those buildings on 9/11, my dad's a New York City firefighter, and thank heavens he retired before 9/11. But exactly what those guys are made of is what my dad is made out of. And I know he's on the show, and they have him acting like a little bit of a nincompoop, and I think he would wear that badge honorably. But he's a loving, brave man, and man, he's my everything. And to be out there with him on that show, it was one of the highlights of his life. And for me to be able to give that to him, it's just what a gift. I'll be eternally grateful to Mark Burnett, Survivor, and everyone that made it possible for that 1 minute alone. I mean, I think there were like 28 million or 30 million people tuning in that episode. Mm-hmm. And they got to know my dad. And that's another thing I want to talk about Survivor, Rob, is that, you know, it was really, a lot of people say it was like the first big reality show. I mean, yeah, The Real World was before, but it was really the first of an era. Sure. That is still ongoing. And it's also like the last of an era, the way I see it, is that it was like the really last big show that all of America was tuning in real time. I mean, Super Bowls aside, NBA championships aside, but everyone was tuning in real time, you know, that you weren't DVRing it. And most people weren't even recording it because they didn't want to be wrong. They were making it home at 8 o'clock to watch the show when it started and when it ended in real time. And it was a real shared American experience. And now it's very different, regardless of what show you watch. Everyone's DVRing it, watching things a la carte. And it was really just the last of a, it was, yes, the first of an era, but also the last of an era. And I was really glad to be part of that.
Yeah. And this week, the website TheRinger.com had a list of the top 100 TV shows of this century, and they had the original Survivor finale, I think, at number 7 on the list. So still a very, very high praise for that event of over 50 million people were going to be there for that finale. And you were there. You got to see Sue Hawk give that speech at that, that famous iconic speech. What was that like, just sort of in the real time as it was happening?
Well, I mean, just, you know, with Sue and I's relationship, Sue and I, I hate when people say that, and I just said with our relationship, Sue and I, we had a very collegial, fun relationship, I thought. And she, if any questions out there that she wrote that speech, let me tell you, she wrote that speech word for word, because she was out there reading it, practicing it. And she asked me how to spell a couple of things, or is this the right way to say it? I mean, I wouldn't say I proofread her script. I certainly didn't write it for her. I didn't correct it for her. I didn't do anything. But I remember reading parts of it. I was like, Sue, that's genius. That's great. You know, I remember seeing that. And a couple of things, maybe I corrected a comma or whatever it was here and there. But she wrote that whole thing. And I was privy enough to see it before. I remember I could see it yesterday, her sitting on this little picnic table out there, looking at it and writing it and doing what she wants to say. That was all Sue. And it was amazing. And that whole finale was just electrifying from a spectator point of view also, because they had us all at in L.A. at the CBS studios, and we're in some big auditorium. I think it was the Chinese Man Theater, actually. And they had all these big TVs around like where the balcony is. And, you know, they all had survivor parties across America. Let's just say there was 8 or 10 of them. And as the votes were being read, all the audience would erupt. Like, one was for Kelly or one was for Richard. And then that final one, when it came up for Richard, when Jeff turned over the last vote for Richard, the whole studio erupted. We're like, no!
Yeah.
And you could see everyone in all the parties across America, all the home survivor watch parties, all of them were like, no! And some people jumping like they knew it was going to happen. But it was just such a thing. And to see how this show possessed an entire country, it was just really amazing to see. Just as someone who observes people for a living, it was just amazing to see and be part of. It was just really something else.
Were you close at all to giving your vote to Kelly for the finale?
No. Richard deserved it. I mean, you know, going back 100 times out of 100, I don't think – listen, Kelly's a competitor. She's a good person. And, you know, I think that she needs the money more than Richard does, you know, so she had the heart. But Richard, he was the puppet master. I mean, Kelly didn't do anything outside of – you know, first of all, there was Kelly who was the puppet master, and then Sue who was like second puppet master, and then Kelly, you know. And Kelly's a good competitor, but she didn't do anything really out there that really – she's just kind of hitched a ride, which is in and of itself a strategy and an effective strategy. But again, you know, my feeling back then was that, you know, as annoying as Richard Hatch is, I don't think he would – I don't think Richard would doubt or second guess that about himself. As annoying as he is, think about the mental gymnastics that that guy had to go through just to make it to the finals, being as annoying as he is, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's why he got my vote, because – with my personality, I couldn't get there, and I get along with everybody, and I couldn't even come close. I mean, I got fifth place. That's close enough, and I honestly just missed out-competing Kelly on one of the things. But I could have been there a little bit longer, maybe. But at the same time, Richard deserved it. I mean, anyone who watched the show critically would say Richard deserved it. Not to take anything away from Kelly, but if I can vote 100 times out of 100, it would be Richard over and over again, because he was the one that really – controlled the game. I mean, he played the game, he played everybody, and he controlled the game from start to finish.
Sean, I have some questions here from the listeners of the podcast, if you have time for some questions from the listeners. This is a question a lot of people wanted to know. This is from Ryan Muldowney. Do you still have a nipple ring?
No.
A lot of people were curious about that.
You know, I had the nipple ring for a while, for probably 2-3 years. I had about like 2 years prior to Survivor, about 2 years afterwards. And it might have been my wife. I started dating my wife shortly after I moved to Florida that I got rid of it. Or maybe
she said,
there was
it's time.
Yeah, it was time. You know, and everything has a place and a time. And, you know, listen, when you're as square as I am, I'm not a non-drinker, but I hardly drink. I've never done a drug in my life. I've never smoked a cigarette in my life, not even picked up a cigarette. Mm-hmm. I've never done any of that stuff. That you want to do something every now and then that makes you feel a little edgy.
Right.
You know, young and silly. And that was it for me. It made me feel a little bit edgy.
I can relate to that, Sean.
Yeah, what? You have one also?
No. You know what? When I was in college, I got like
the testicular ring, right?
Yeah. Prince Albert, I believe.
Right.
The name for it. I got my my ear pierced in like the top of my ear. I felt like that like, oh, the women will really right. think that, boy, this is such a rebel.
Right. See, what girls don't realize is, like, guys, we need every advantage that we can, every single advantage to get what we want. And to me, that's what it was. It was like, all right, you know, if, you know, no one knows about it, I'm a respectable, professional human being. And then when you take your shirt off, A, you want to look good. You want to have some abs or something. But you also want to be like, oh, that's weird. That's weird that he has that, you mm-hmm. know. And I didn't want to permanently scar my body with a tattoo. But there's nothing that I hold, like, so true in my life that I would want to put it on my skin. So, you know, the next best option was get a nipple ring, which is what I did.
This is a question from Dan Heaton. When Survivor became a sensation, how big of a change did it have on your life at home? I always say that you guys from the first season, you guys were like the Beatles for, you know, months after the show. Well, what was that experience like for you?
Well, it was really cool because I'm neither a celebrity file where I don't love celebrities and live and eat and breathe for celebrity life. And I also don't hate celebrities. A lot of people, oh, just because on TV, he's a big jerk or whatever. You know, I like them. They're people. And it was just kind of cool of going from like an ordinary person's life. And like I said, I grew up very blue collar. I was in the white collar world. But then to get behind the velvet rope, it's really amazing to see. And, you know, you realize everyone's just a person, but you meet all these celebrities. I walked the red carpet at the MTV Video Music Awards. Mm-hmm. I was there with Prince, with Madonna, with Britney Spears. You're in the newspaper with these people. You're on the cover of all these magazines. You know, I went to like fancy parties with all these people. I've met celebrities. I've hung out with them. You just get to see how the other side lives, and you realize that there's this gross insecurity in Hollywood and in music and all of those places that aren't really a part of your life as an ordinary human being. Most people don't wake up insecure and think like, oh, is no one going to like me at work today? Or is everyone going to think that I'm not the best postman or the best paper shuffler or whatever, or the best car washer? Like, none of us wake up that way. They're like, oh, I hope the people still like me at my car wash. We all hope that everyone likes you throughout life, but most of us get up and we do our jobs every day and without really thinking about it. But these people are hanging in the balance, no matter who they are. Just think back to the TV stars of the 80s. Where are they now? You know, that they're here today and gone tomorrow. And that overwhelming insecurity, you can see it on their faces. And when they hang out, they're friends, but they're not friends once you're behind the velvet rope. Everyone's here today, but could be gone tomorrow. It's a very vacuous and empty environment for anyone that's curious as to what it's like behind there. Now, that being said, I met some wonderful people while I was there. Haley Joel Osment, you know, from the
Sixth Sense. You know,
Sixth Sense. He and his whole family couldn't be better. Howard Stern couldn't be better. Donny Osmond predictably couldn't be better. Regis Philbin couldn't be better. You know, but then, you know, other people are bigger jerks, and I'll leave them out of it. But there was a, like Chevy Chase, for instance. Most people think, oh, I thought he was probably going to be a jerk. He couldn't be a nicer person. At least he was to me. Other people are more standoffish, like Steve Martin, who I used to love, the comedian. He was kind of standoffish. You know, a bunch of other people. And I met a whole bunch of people that were kind of just jerky. But you meet some wonderful people as well in there. And you're like, wow, that person was really cool. We would have been good friends at another time and place. But just seeing how they – just getting behind that velvet rope and being there for a little bit was really cool. And let me tell anybody in your listening audience is that I think it was Eugene O'Neill, the playwright, very famous playwright, who said, success is a stale finale. And, you know, on the backdrop that – I tried to get on MTV back in 95 and always wanted to do medical television. Then after Survivor, I had a pretty big job at CBS News being one or two of their health reporters. I did network shows. I've done all kinds of stuff. It really is a stale finale. TV is very much the cesspool that a lot of people assume it to be. It really is. And it's very backstabbing. It's very capricious. And it's not a meritocracy that you don't, you know, those who earn the most, those who do the best aren't usually the ones that are the most talented. And that's all what I've been able to see since I've observed it. And once you're there, you say to yourself, you know, that I think that saying always resonated with me. Success is a stale finale. And once you get to where you wanted to be or where you thought you wanted to be your entire life, you kind of say to yourself, this is not what I thought it was going to be. This is not what I thought it was. And that's really how I feel about TV and that whole celebrity life, that it really was a stale finale. I enjoyed it. I got to go see some cool people. I have a whole bunch of cool stories. But at the same time, I can't see that that would be sustaining for anybody. And if it was sustained for you, let's just take a Madonna or a Brad Pitt or whoever's, you know, has been able to sustain a high degree of celebrity for a very long period of time, I would say that they're probably not enjoying their life as much as you think they are, and they may not even be enjoying their life as much as you are. So, that's kind of like my observation from what I've seen. But it changed my life pretty steeply, I would say.
So, Sean, right before we started the podcast, you were telling me real quick about how that you, when you went to go work for CBS doing medical news after the show. And we're doing that for some time up until, when was it, 2008?
Yeah, 2008 or 2009, I forget. It was right around the housing crisis and financial crisis that I by all accounts, I was a really good reporter, medical reporter for CBS News. I got tons of praise. Excellent reviews, quarterly, annually. CBS Network asked me to jump. I said, how high? And I never questioned anything. I was a good soldier. I worked hard for them. I think I had to balance my medical career with reporting. And I think I took 2 weeks of vacation in 9 years. That's how good of a reporter, of an employee I was. And then, you know, during the financial crisis of those years, I show up to work one day. And they're like, oh, well, you know, CBS eliminated your position and others like it across the board, across the nation. Like, it's nothing, you know, it's nothing personal. I had already survived, you know, at this point, like, you know, anyone who's worked in television, we call them bloodbaths. Mm-hmm. I already survived like 20 bloodbaths at the network. But you just show up one day after doing nothing wrong. I show up and you're, you know, all of a sudden you don't have a job. Now, fortunately, I'm a neurologist. That's my day job, you know. But I just went back to practicing full time and not doing journalism at all. But, you know, left me with a question, like, when did it become okay to let go of a good worker without a good reason? And all of a sudden, that's like, that's okay all of a sudden. That you can be great, but just for the bottom dollar, you let them go. And when they say things to you like, hey, this is nothing personal – I'm sort of like, screw you. It is personal because, A, I like my job. I got to tell a little medical story every day, interpreted statistics, put a little mini movie on CBS News, and then millions of people would see it and see me. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it was very important to me. I took a lot of pride in my job, as I do with all things. And then also, that was my primary paycheck at the time. So, it's like, you know, what do you mean it's nothing personal? For me, it's personal. Like, this is very personal for me. The job itself is personal, and my ability to put food on my table and pay my bills is personal. So I was very hurt by that, and I saw a lot of really good people going under, you know, that they were upside down in their house. They lost their life savings in the stock market and they lost their jobs. And these are ordinary Americans. And so that's when I went, I was passing by on my way home from CBS News and I passed this cow pasture and I saw this bull with his, well, a cow actually, with his head stuck in the fence. And I sort of, that's how I feel. I feel like I've been a cow for the last 9 years or 8 years of my life for CBS News. And just do what they said. And, you know, ultimately you're an expendable commodity to them and they don't really care. And that's really how I felt. So I went to live with the cows for 40 days in and around my neighborhood.
Yeah, what does that mean? You went to go live with the cows?
Well, you can't just live because there's a liability. So I spoke to two ranchers and they wouldn't let me in. At the point, I didn't know anything about cows at this point. Or how they behaved or how big they were even. I'm a New York City guy, you know, so I didn't know anything about cows. So they wouldn't let me in. And when they wouldn't let me in, I started jumping the fences in the middle of the night and I would camp out there. And one of them had a steer, a neutered bull, but still with too much testosterone. So I would have to hide for that field. I would have to hide behind Jersey barriers. But by and large, cows are pretty docile. And most I would just sit there and have a tent or just sleep there in a sleeping bag and watch them in the day, kind of like a field study. And I wrote the book, you know, Etre the Cow, to be the cow. Etre in French means to be. Etre.
Yes.
Means to be. And it's a really personal book. It was like my inside spilled out at that time. It's just all my feelings. I just felt like I had to exercise it to get it out, to put it out there. I mean, anything I've ever done in my life, and I've done a lot of really cool things personally. I mean, of course, raising my children is number one. Marrying my beautiful wife is number two. Mm-hmm. But anything that I've done for myself, I'm most proud of that book. It's kind of a mixture between Franz Kafka, The Metamorphosis, when Gregor wakes up as a beetle, and sort of also with a little Albert Camus, The Stranger, where he finds himself in an existential crisis.
Yes.
And it's all written from the point of view of a pasture bull who begins to question his life, like, where am I going with my life? And if I'm so powerless over my life, who has the power and what can I do about it? And I really wrote it for me, but wrote it for the time. I think it reflects the time. Got great reviews, like got a lot of good critical reviews, but Jane Goodall loved it. I think it's still on Jane Goodall's website. She says it's one of the best books she ever read. And Archbishop Desmond Tutu liked it, the Nobel Prize, Peace Prize winner. So, you know, got a lot of critical acclaim, a lot of personal acclaim from people that I admire. But really, I was just trying to write something that was inside my soul at the time and just get it out, because I didn't want to have it living in my heart. So that's really what that book's about.
And I'll link to it in the show notes, available on Amazon. Sean, what can we learn from the cows and the bulls?
Well, you know, we're all powerless to a certain extent. And the if you read the book, it kind of leaves you with more questions than answers. It's a philosophical book, but I think you'll like it. It's very, very, it's easy to read, but it's going to leave you with a lot of thoughts, a lot to chew on, if you pardon the ruminant, ruminating pun. But yeah, it's going to leave you with a lot to chew on. But, you know, we all have someone to answer to, no matter what you're doing. And you may not be as powerful in your life as you think. You know, but I don't really know. Like I said, I was just trying to exercise some demons. I didn't realize what it was going to become. I was publishing another book at the time, Stop Effing Yourself. And I just come from – and my publisher was like, why are you in jeans and dirty? I was like, oh, I just came from the cow pasture. I'm writing this other book. And they really wanted that book badly also. So that's kind of how it all happened. But I was just going to bind it up and share it with my children one day about how I was feeling at this point in my life. But yeah, I mean, you'll recognize, if you read it, you'll recognize yourself, or you'll recognize other people in your lives. I mean, it's a ubiquitous feeling, this impotence, this feeling of powerlessness over our circumstances. And it's kind of an ode to that powerlessness and that shared human experience. And you're not alone. I think that's what you would get from it. But I do want to say something to your podcast. Like, I've had a very rich life. My wife thinks I'm like Homer Simpson. I've had every job in the book. I stumble onto the nation's number one TV show. I've written books. You know, I've been on TV. I've had my own radio show. I'm a really solid, good, thoughtful neurologist. I just had a very wonderful life. And I always tell people that whatever your dream job is, whatever it is, think about pursuing it. Because let's just say your dream job is to become a singer, and your backup job is to become an accountant. Or let's just say your dream job is to become the next Ellen DeGeneres, that you want to be a talk show host or a comedian turned talk show host. There's a lot of people out there, millions, 30 million, 20 million, whatever it is, going through the CPA courses trying to become an accountant. And your competition to become an accountant and get a good job as an accountant is a lot steeper than the amount of people who are investing the same amount of time, the same amount of energy, and the same amount of gusto into becoming Ellen DeGeneres. Like, if you pursue your dream job with all the gusto that it's taking you to become an accountant or a lawyer or a medical doctor, whatever it's going to be, and you take all that time that you would be investing in that and you pursue one of your dream careers, you're going to find yourself with a lot less competition than you think. You do have to work hard with everything. You have to work hard. But believe me, everyone has dreams, but very few people are willing to work very hard at those dreams. So, you know, I can't promise you, again, going back to Eugene O'Neill, that, like, as in my case, I got everything that I wanted, and I found that success was very much a stale finale. Don't get me wrong. If they offer me a role in the next Star Wars, I'd take it tomorrow, you know? I'd find my lightsaber. I'd be out there starring. I mean, anybody would. But at the same time,
Episode 9,
right? You know, success is very much a sale finale. But if you have a burning desire to become something, go at it with all your heart, because that's what I've always done in my life, and I've had amazing experiences because of it. No one's really watching. No one's watching your failures. No one really cares. Everyone's so egocentric. They're all caught up in their own little lives. Any failure you have is going to be a blip on their radar. Just be big, be bold, pursue your dream job. And if you pursue it with gusto, I guarantee you, you'll meet a lot less resistance than you think.
If you have a goal and you really convince yourself that you will stop at nothing until you get it, you will figure out a way to get there.
Absolutely. And that's been testament in my life. And that's how it is with most people are successful at what they want. It's like they just always knew they would get there. That's all they ever wanted. And, you know, I'm not saying that once you get there, you're not going to want to abandon ship and get the heck out of there. Mm-hmm. But at the same time is, you know, if it's I believe in God, and I believe that God puts little things inside you. Like, that's your calling, and that's who you should be. And listen to that voice, because that voice, I think, you know, listen, I don't have it all figured out. You know, I'm not supposed to know godly things. I'm just an Irish doctor from New York City. You know, I don't know. But at the same time is that little voice, listen to it, because it's trying to make you what you're supposed to be. And just pursue it. And like I said, if you go hard at anything, there's so many people working very hard to be a doctor or a lawyer, be jobs they don't necessarily want to be. If you invested that same amount of energy, same amount of time, I'm talking about every book you picked up to study for that, trying to be a better comedian, trying to be a better talk show host and working on your craft, you'll see. Yeah, the universe can't stop that kind of power. So, you know, go for it.
One or two more quick questions that we had. A lot of people wanted to know, have you ever been reached out to by CBS to go back on another season of the show?
Yeah, I mean, they've contacted me three times, twice to invite me back on. And I said, thanks, but no thanks. Once when I was, you know, just I was working, I think, for CBS or something like that. And I expressed really no interest. You know, it was an email that they sent out to a few people that were on the list. And I said, no, I'm out this time. You know, I have enough silliness in my life. And then they contacted me again, I would say, you know, maybe a year or two ago to be part of one of the other shows, like, you know, people from the past or something like that. And again, I declined. I have a wife and three kids now, and my life is different. I love, you know, what it gave me. I love the Survivor family. I love the Survivor fan base. They've all been amazing to me, despite, you know, despite whatever psychological ineptitude they think I conducted myself. But, you know, that's part of the game. That's part of the fun. But no, I don't think I would ever go back. I have a couple of good ideas that I sent that they you know, asked us for any ideas. One of them I thought of, I called it Survivor Parallel Worlds. So you strand two different, you know, you cast them exactly the same. Each side has a villain. Each side has a babe. Each side has a jerk. Each side has, you know, a schemer, a thug, whatever. You have everyone out there, but you have 16 on one that airs on Monday, 16 on another island that airs on Tuesday, and you have two simultaneous Survivor shows. I know it's a big nut, but then you see how these all play out in different realms. And then at the end, you not only merge the tribes, like everyone thinks they're going through it, then you actually merge the teams when you get down to like a final eight on each thing. Then you have yet a third show. So I think that could be fun, because what could be fun about that is, like, it'd be interesting to see if you end up with a schemer at the end of both shows or a villain at the end of both shows. They're going through the same challenges, the same trials, just for the same amount of days. It'd be interesting to see how different one island is compared to another island at the end of, you know, let's just say a final four, what you're left with at the final four in one show versus a final four in another show.
Use the same challenges. Jeff's already there.
Right. Yeah. And then you get a twofer, you know, survivors would like that. But then at the same time, it's like, it just isn't, you know, because Survivor is a TV show, but it's also a psychological experiment. In fact, when my wife was in college, she read in her sociology textbook, there's a picture of Survivor on there in our sociology textbook. So, you know, it'd be an interesting sociological experiment to see at the very end if, you know, if you're left with, yeah, it's funny, we're left with the strongman, a villain, the BITCH, and the tag along on both shows, you know, and then now you put them together and see what happens. So, you know, just be an interesting psychological experiment, I think, to see. It'd be something I'd want to see, something I would watch on Survivor, and it'd be double the fun for the Survivor fans. So that's really the last time that they contacted me, and sort of on that, I was like, hey, listen, a lot of the old Survivor fan base are asking if you're on the show. Are you still a no for the show? And then also, if we're taking any ideas, do you have any ideas about how we could reinvent the show or do something fun? And I wrote them back, yes, I'm still a no. And but it wasn't like a real offer. But it was, yes, I'm still a no. And I have a hard time believing, like, there's thousands of fans out there that want to see me do my thing out there.
No, again. There's millions.
At the age of 48. Nah, my day in the sun is over. I don't think anybody wants to see me. So, but if so, you know, if there's like this movement to get me back out to the show and I can clear it with my wife, maybe I would do it. But right now, life is too good. I don't need any bug bites.
Yeah, Sean, wait until you're 72 and then come in, and then you could be like the new Rudy with a bunch of kids.
Maybe I will. Maybe I will. Maybe I'll become a Navy SEAL or a CIA agent in the meantime. You know, do something else.
You're Navy SEAL.
Yeah.
You'd be, you know, I don't know these kids, and they don't know me.
Right. That'd be great. That'd be great. Maybe I'll wait till I get crotchety enough.
Sean, a lot of people also wanted to know that in the last couple of years, Jervis has gone back and played. Kelly has gone back and played. Out of curiosity, did you tune in to see how they did?
No, you know, I mean, I follow along on Facebook. Honestly, like, I'm so busy at work. I work like 100 hours a week. It's crazy at work, and I'm very fulfilled by my work, which is, you know, I do hospital neurology, so I take care of brain tumors, bleeding in the brain, strokes, comas, like, you know, it's pretty mentally intensive, emotionally intensive. And, when I come home, I just kind of want to hang out with my kids and my wife. And we do watch The Bachelor for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. My wife got me into it a long time ago. I enjoy the show because it's kind of like popcorn for the brain. You don't have to think too hard. It's kind of comical. What people don't understand about The Bachelor is that it's campy by intention.
Yes.
And I find that really fun. And I know a couple of the producers. Turns out some of the producers were from my hometown way back when. But yeah, I mean, I watch that. That's really the only appointment TV I watch. And I can't afford more than one appointment TV because I just don't have the time with mm-hmm. the three kids. I mean, I watch Peppa Pig.
Yeah.
I watch a lot of Peppa Pig, a lot of Bubble Guppies. I watch a lot of that stuff, but I don't get a lot of time. But, you know, I wish everybody well. We shared this wonderful experience. And, you know, it's just a matter of, you know, priorities in my life. I just don't have time for it.
And, Sean, last question that this is from Ron Chan. Do you know what happened to Colleen Haskell, a.k.a. Colleen? Have you ever heard an update on what she has been doing in the last 15 years?
No, I mean, I hope she goes on with her. I mean, I think right after Survivor, we all toured the country around. I saw her a lot in the aftermath of Survivor for that first year.
Sure.
She did some acting. She did some design. And, you know, she's I think, graphic designer by trade. So I would assume she might be married, might be a graphic designer, maybe a mom. I mean, I hope because even though Survivor is a wonderful experience, it can't even come close to being a mom because being a dad is amazing. And I've heard being a mom is even more amazing. So I wish that for her. But no, I haven't really heard from her outside of that first or second year. I do recall, like, God, maybe it was 10 to 12 years ago, we touched base or something through either Facebook or something at the time or email, or there was like a double email between Jenna and Greg and me or something. I do remember hearing, he says, oh, that's weird. You know, there's Colleen, but I kind of keep to myself. Like I said, you know, Survivor's wonderful. I mean, obviously it changed your life, right? Look at you, you know, how much has changed your life? If that didn't happen to you, your life would be so different. You'd probably still be the same guy, but your life would be so different. So it adds so much to your life and it brings so much. But for me, like, you know, I've always been not a loner, but, you know, just kind of like a solitary person. I just kind of keep things to myself. I keep my ideas to myself. Like, you know, I just want to move on. And, you know, like I said, and if I thought that there was a real thundering audience for me that was asking me to come back and to see me run around when I'm, you know, in one tenth the shape I was back then, you know, and do my thing, you know, I'd probably do it just because out of respect to the fans and everything. But, you know, I think, you know, CBS was very good about keeping us in the limelight for more than our 15 minutes, which was great.
Mm-hmm.
But then it was very important that we all disappeared. And I really, you know, felt that I wanted to disappear because I wanted to give, you know, your Colby and your Tina Wesson and your whatever, it's their turn to have the limelight. You know, I had my time, and same thing with you, you know, it's time for Rob to shine. So, you know, it was, you know, not that I could have outshone any of those people I just mentioned, including yourself. But that's kind of how I thought of it, is mm-hmm. that, you know, listen, I had my fun in the sun. The last thing I want is, you know, to have people being like, come on, Kniff, you already had your
right.
15 minutes of fame. Go away already. Who cares about you? Like, first of all, I don't feel that way about myself, and I don't want people thinking that about myself. So, you know, I enjoyed the experience for what it was. I mean, I don't think I've heard anybody say that about me. In particular, because I'm not that person, and I don't need that to fulfill myself. And I'm not saying that those others do, but I just wouldn't want people to think that of me. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, that's what holds me back. Right or wrong, you know, do it 100 times if you want. Do it, you know, walk around with a big neon sign over your head, say, I was one of the original survivors for all I care. Like, but I didn't want people thinking of me like, oh, look, there's Sean again, the dopey neurologist. You know, your 15 minutes are up, buddy. Get out of here. You know, because I'm not a loser, and I don't want to give anyone I never considered myself a loser. I don't consider myself a loser. No one I know who knows me personally considers myself a loser, so, you know, I kind of wanted it that way. And I think that you hit a certain point when you finish fifth place on the nation's number one TV show and you keep airing your face in public, you know, like, mm-hmm. here I am, who wants an autograph? I think that's a very natural thing for people to say, you know, go away, you've had your time. So before people said that, I just bowed out. And, you know, I think for me, it was the right decision.
Well, Sean, we really appreciate you taking some time to talk with us about your whole experience. Again, I just want to tell you, so appreciated. I know you don't do a lot of this stuff, so thank you for coming on and talking
with us.
You're
the only one, my friend. I think you're the only one. You're certainly the only one for the last at least 10 to 15 years, I mean, for sure. So, okay.
Well,
and congratulations to you for doing so successful and doing everything you're doing with the Rob Has a Podcast. I mean, it's really amazing what you've been able
Sean,
to do.
Sean, thank you so much. I had no idea that you had any sort of awareness of any of this.
So you're a pretty big deal. You've actually made it. So you've been able to turn, you know, your notoriety. Well, notoriety is a bad word, but your renown into something really productive and really great and really fun. So congratulations to you, man. It's not easy to do.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Sean. And again, what a thrill it was to talk to you from Massapequa, Long Island. I'm a Wantagh
very
guy.
Close to Wantagh.
Yes, right. Yes. Same Long Island Railroad Babylon line.
I got my butt kicked. You know, I was a high school wrestler, a pretty competitive one, and Tommy Ryan out there kicked my butt every year, man. Tommy Ryan, he went on to the NCAA finals twice, I think.
Yes.
And now he's the coach, I think, of Hofstra or Iowa. It's one of those big schools. I don't know. But he kicked my butt so many times, that guy. But yeah, Wantagh strikes fear in my heart. But not because of you, Rob.
No, I hope not. So many famous Massapequa residents. Jerry Seinfeld, the Baldwin brothers.
Yeah, all the Baldwin brothers.
Joey Buttafuoco.
Joey Buttafuoco. Yeah, we have a few more. I forget who they are, but actually, Justin Bieber's girlfriend now is one of the Baldwin girls, and she's from Massapequa.
Oh.
The model. But yeah, I mean, he's been in the news lately. Justin Bieber walking around with the Massapequa t-shirt. But yeah, it's a very strange
stuttering place. John Melendez.
Yeah, we have a lot of people from the Massapequa area who end up making it for whatever reason. It's got to be the water or something. But yeah, who knows? It wasn't me. You know, it's funny. There is a Hall of Fame or something like that, like famous Massapequa people. And somehow I'm on that list.
Hey, but, I'm looking at you on the Wikipedia page for Massapequa.
Right, yeah. So, but it's kind of funny. You know, I'll take it. I'll take what I can get.
Yeah. Sean, is there anything that you want people to check out? I know we talked about the book, Etra the Cow. Anything else?
Cow, if you listen, it's cheap. It's good. Listen, it'll add to your life. If you want to buy a book and support the survivor community and me, you won't be disappointed. It's E-T-R-E, Etra, which means French. In French, it means to be. So it's to be the cow. And it's all about a pasture bull who finds himself powerless on the pasture and wonders how he could change things.
Get it on Kindle or audiobook?
Everything. Kindle, audiobook. It's in bookstores. You know, you can get it from anywhere. It did really well for a while, but you know, listen, you got to be into that kind of thing.
You read the audiobook?
Do I read no, I don't read the audiobook. And the guy who read the audiobook, I wouldn't recommend the audiobook so much over the paper copy, because he doesn't sound like what I had Etra's voice in my head being, but I didn't make the decision for that. But it's good. I mean, I think has great reviews. To give it a poor review, I think you really either wouldn't have read it or, you know, you didn't understand it. I mean, it's just, you know, it's my inner feelings poured out on the page, if it matters to anybody. But I think it's a universal experience. And out of anything I've done in my life personally, including Survivor, I'm most proud of that. You know, even above and beyond my medical career, because I've been able to help people's lives in medicine, and I'm a really compassionate and good doctor. You know, that was just, you know, gumption and staying with it and stuff. But when that happened to me, I was in a really dark place. I'm a very effervescent guy. I'm a very happy guy by nature. And when that happened to me, when I lost my job, you know, I didn't deserve it. I was angry. I was sad. I was humiliated. I was emasculated. I was a bunch of things. And it really put me in a place where I've never been before. And to be able to take that moment and those feelings and turn it into something that I love and is beautiful is really, I think, you know, testimony to my spirit that I, you know, that was able to turn something horrible into something really good. And I'm very proud of that. So, you know, you can buy it on Amazon in a bookstore, whatever, and then go on to trash it if you want. But it's a really, I think I'm very proud of it. So, but outside of that, but you know, no one's reading nowadays. I'm not going to be upset if no one goes out and buys it either. So don't worry about it. Right. Even I'm not reading. I'm a voracious reader, and even I don't read anymore. So,
yeah, well, Sean, thank you again. This was so much fun, and all the best to you and your family.
Thanks, Robin, to yours too. Thanks for having me. You've been a blast. Thanks, buddy.
All right, everybody. There you have it. Dr. Sean Kniff here on Rob Has a Podcast. Really excited we were able to get that one for you. And it was a thrill for me to go back and look at all of my notes from Borneo and then to talk to Dr. Sean. So really a thrill for me. I don't know what it is about these, you know, hyper-sexed doctors from Florida, but I feel like we get along so well here on the podcast. So much survivor stuff going on all around the world. We've had great international survivor coverage all through the summer with Shannon Gates covering Survivor New Zealand, which just recently wrapped up. Survivor South Africa is coming to a close very soon, and Survivor Australia or Australian Survivor just kicked off the new season. A lot of interest, of course, with Russell Hance being a part of Australian Survivor. Nick Iadanza has the recap of the first week of Australian Survivor action with Stephen Fishbeck. All that is up on robhasawebsite.com. If you are looking for a convenient way to track down all of the links for International Survivor, there are so many different ways that you could do that. We try to make it as easy as possible for our patrons in our patron Facebook group. We keep a Google spreadsheet with all of the links to all the different Survivor editions around the world, so you could follow along with all the International Survivor podcasts that we have going on as well. All right, so that's going to do it for us here. Hopefully I can track down a couple other survivors that are off the grid over the course of this summer and bring you more interviews like this. We also have some other survivor fun coming up soon as well. So be on the lookout for that. Make sure you subscribe to Rob Has a Podcast by going to robhasawebsite.com/iTunes. We always appreciate your feedback and star ratings in the Apple Podcast Store. Take care, everybody. Have a good one. Bye.